Star Lake in Sidelsing, Levens Creek.
Oh, bees in Star Lake, broke my head off. Three things I remember very well. That was, we were always hungry. We didn't eat, was known that you were only 15 to 18 years old. Second, the drill, the inhuman drill, not only a drill like soldiers in a caserne, you know, but they were so angry with us because we dared, a little country, young people of a little country dared to go against the big German Reich. So they let us know that every day. And third, on three or four evenings, they tried to make of us good Germans, to indoctrinate us, good Germans, good Nazi Germans. Just an example. There was a meadow just in the middle of the vineyards, and you know, vineyards are public. Yes. And in the morning when it was wet, they forced us, we were 180 young men, they forced us to run down and come up 20 times, 30 times. So the last times we had just to crawl above because we couldn't run again. Or we had to exercise what they call Stechschritt, that means the typical Prussian
field walk. Well, there's a drill walk.
Parade march. You see, when legs had to be just in
horizontal. It's on horizontal, you do here.
Yeah.
Could you begin that again and just say it? Parade march is good.
Another time they forced us to make their typical Prussian parade march where legs has been just on in front of the stomach. But not on the floor, but go down or go up. So you know, I couldn't go. It's just too
stop the tape.
But meanwhile, our parents didn't know where we were for weeks. They have written a letter to us, to our parents, to say that they were not able to educate us in the Nazi manner, so they took the education to the Hitler Youth. But after 4 weeks, parents could visit us, but just once, and just parents, nobody else. And that's why we could have pictures of our group because parents were in the castle. Before we didn't have a camera or something else. It was forbidden in the first week because we didn't to write letters and to have feelings. Just to say, for instance, near the Rhine, there was a very muddy place, and we had to exercise there every day, nearly every day, in the mud when it had rained. But it was raining, it was mud of at least 10 centimeters high, and when we came back to the castle, made 100 steps to go up. We had to wash, I had just one uniform. We had to wash that uniform, and in 5 minutes we had to stand again in the court of the castle. So it was just pure punishment.
Other punishments.
For instance, when you spoke during eating, you have to take your chair above like that, your plate on that, and stay there just as long as the other comrades eat. Or another, when you all thought you had, they punished you in a special grid for 1 hour what they called tango bis. That it was a tango medal, again from between the white yards. So I can say that we were 160, about 160, because 20 of our comrades were put to. They had to join the German army because they were of the class 20 to 24. And all those men couldn't, after their service in the caserne.
Barracks.
When they had finished in the barracks, they couldn't go home for holiday, but they put them immediately to Russia, and most of them never came back from 42 on. But I can say that all that comradeship we had at that time, all those, because we were two schools, one school here in Nash and one in Eshtemach, who we didn't know each other, but we afterwards we were so, it was so great comradeship that when we returned on December 10th, after just 101 days, we showed the Nazi officer or sergeants who greeted us that it was all their indoctrination was in vain. You know why? When we passed the border from Germany to Luxembourg to train. We opened all windows and we sang our anthem, Luxembourg anthem. Singing the anthem, in the Luxembourg anthem, meant prison or concentration camp. But they didn't put us again to the concentration camp. When we came back on December 10th, they wanted to show us to the population, to show to the population where we were, that we were good Germans, and we had to make a march through the main street of coming back to Esch. They wanted to show to the population that we were good Nazi Germans by marching through the main street and by making a meeting just for our parents, and then afterwards we were permitted to go home, definitely. But to go to school, our parents had to write a letter, and we just were in school afterwards for the rest of the season as Gastschüler. Hostess students or hostess students.
Okay, and now after that, what happened? You went into the German army, or what happened then?
Yes, we finished our class. We had to go to work by the farmers for 3 months, and then the next class we were just fortnight in the class, so we had to our class had to go to what they called FLAG, that's the DCA. That was the guns to protect our light guns to protect our factories. And so that was just our chance, myself, that we were not forced to go to Russia. So we stayed here. They said until January 1945, and those Americans had blown them off.
What happened when the Americans came? I mean, you were in German uniform.
The first American I saw was at the post office, just in, I think it was a sergeant. They were two, the driver and the sergeant, and the Nazis went off. That means the first time, no, on the 1st of September, they escaped for the first time with the Nazis, but they came back. That means when the Americans didn't come so fast as we wanted to, they came back for a week, and they took all those young men who are hidden. And who came out of their house and the bunkers and where they were hidden. So they had to hide again, but they took some to prison again to Germany. But the second time, when Americans came, definitely it was just one here in Nash, but on September we danced for nights in the main street, just in the streets, with the Americans, with French, with the French soldiers too, and that went on for weeks and weeks.
Did the Americans think you were German troops when they found you?
Oh, I don't think so. They were very bad, very good people.
Apple. Okay, I think that's good. I think you had it there. Do you think there's anything else you would like to tell us? I have what I want about the Starak, and you didn't talk about your anti-aircraft unit, what you did.
I can give you a very, very good detail.
Okay, we're going to get this story. This is about shooting at the plane? Yeah. Wait.
That's okay. Rolling.
Rolling, go.
At the anti-aircraft, we were at the anti-aircraft just for a year. And at the end, we had to shoot twice on American planes. There was once it was a lightning, and second time I don't remember. But we just shoot a bit beside. But the third time, you must know that we had an officer above us, a German officer, who gave the command of. So he made a mistake. He couldn't know that there were planes, and there were American planes and German planes in all around. So when the planes, that they were five or six planes, when they come above us, he gave the command to shoot. We shot three guns of 2 millimeters and three machine guns. Just one of us, he tried to shoot beneath or the side, but he shot down the German plane. Afterwards, we didn't laugh at that because we were persuaded that we would have very, very difficulties, or many difficulties. But it was a German officer who made the command, who had the command.
Ah bon.
Okay. Als nächstes können wir Monsieur Nulli war, dass den Ernst von sich das nimmt, den Intel, die wir zur Zeit am Esch kann, als Mondo.
General Donovan of the OSS was a big help to us when it came to techniques of interrogation. We never used any recording devices, as I've made clear in the past. Our job is to the interrogator was an enlisted man interrogating an officer. And that was a technique that sometimes helped. The way of intimidating. It worked the other way in the course of interrogation too. By upgrading the interrogator, but you could be a general officer interrogating an enlisted man, and that fear would be the same. The other thing was to be totally unsympathetic toward a prisoner. If he said something funny, you just didn't laugh. So sort of kept a poker face. If he said something serious, you didn't reflect. You showed no reaction of your own. You didn't nod your head, or you didn't give a negative attitude. You sort of had to be very stoic in your relationship. Which the reaction of the prisoner then was that was automatic. didn't really care what kind of an answer he gave. And the result was that sometimes he would talk more freely if he felt that he wasn't getting any reaction from you. There were just different ways of...
Hang on a second. Okay. What about shock? You talked about registering shock when it was appropriate to, or when it was appropriate
just
not.
Even the
yes. Again, giving the kind of if you were really shocked by you had to play, you had to do a certain amount of play acting. If it's something he said was shocking to you, and it was advantageous to show that shock, you would do so. Other times, you would register nothing at all, no reaction at all. So that made a difference, too. So.
Okay. Anything else from Donovan that comes to mind?
Or well, what it really boiled down to is a form of salesmanship. It was selling, convincing the subject that what he was telling you was really not very important. Go ahead and tell me anyhow. Or convincing the subject that what he was telling you was extremely important, and therefore it was to his advantage to respond. It was a technique of selling the goods. And Donovan apparently was an experienced interrogator, and he would sort of tip us off on the best way to approach a certain prisoner in order to get him to talk. That was a role he played primarily in my relationship to him.
But one last thing about interrogation techniques that come to my mind was when you spoke of people feeling like if you didn't talk to somebody, sometimes they felt that, well, why isn't he talking to me? I'm more important. I know more than that guy. Could you talk about that?
Yes. The prisoners, if you did not interrogate a certain prisoner, he lost face with the rest of the crowd. As an internee, you established your own importance by making the other internees think that the enemy, us, the interrogators, thought that he was important. So if a man was not interrogated, he lost face. And they would sometimes come to us and say, you never interrogated me. Why don't you ask me about this? Because I have information. They would sometimes voluntarily come to us because it established their prestige with the other prisoners. If they were never interrogated, they lost face. So they were, in some instances, anxious to talk and volunteered, saying, you know, ask me some questions because it makes me look good with the other guys. Or they would say, you never interrogate me, so why are you keeping me here? That would, in a way, catch us off guard a little bit, because we really didn't know why I was there either. And if he wasn't there, if he was going to be interrogated, why did we have him there? So sometimes we would go to our superior and say, hey, we really don't need this guy. Well, why are we feeding him? Well, why are we bothering with him? And it resulted in the prisoner going home.
Okay. We already talked about Streicher. about the Soviets. Now, let's just talk a little bit about them and to how you came up with the idea that they weren't there really because they were interested in the Nazis. They were there more interested with you guys.
We weren't the only interrogators at Ashcan. Practically every day, an individual would come, or two, or maybe as many as five in a team, to interrogate a certain prisoner or two or three others. This could be an historian from the War Department who was interested in what a particular prisoner had done for historical purposes, or for technical purposes, whatever. So we had interrogators from the United States who were not part of the military intelligence team, or were not related to our operation.
We would have officers from other countries come to interrogate a certain prisoner, or sometimes to talk to us about the result of an interrogation that they wanted more information on. But the most interesting teams were a Soviet team. Somehow they always came with reinforcement, the reinforcement being sometimes a major, a captain, and a lieutenant. The lieutenant would most frequently be a woman. She would speak English fluently. And this team would come to interrogate primarily Keitel, Dönitz, always Göring. I think more out of curiosity than anything else. Their technique of interrogation was to start very early in the morning. When the Soviet team came to interrogate, we had to get up early, because they went by the clock. They quit at exactly 4 o'clock. Their technique was that the major would ask a question. The lieutenant would translate it into English. And then one of us, if I sat in on such an interrogation, would translate it into German for the benefit of the prisoner. The prisoner would answer in German, I'd translate it into English, and she would translate it into Russian. All the time, every time, I had the feeling that all three of them could speak better German than I could. And it always puzzled me, why didn't they conduct their own interrogation in German? Eventually, you got the feeling that they were testing us. They were more interested in seeing how we responded to what they were trying to find out than how the prisoner responded. I had the feeling, in hindsight, that the Cold War actually began in Ashkan, that these people, the Soviets, were really gathering intelligence about us. What led me to this technique of interrogation, first of all. Secondly, when they ended an interrogation, and it was always ended at 4 o'clock, one of them, I think, had the sole responsibility of